Thank you. With this broadcast, we are beginning another new series, which I am entitling The Bases of the Second Coming of Jesus Christ. What I mean by this is that there is one condition that must be met before Christ can return for the purpose of setting up his messianic kingdom. And so this week we shall be discussing what the one precondition to the second coming is. But even before we can adequately begin to deal with the question of what is the basis or the precondition to the second coming, we must raise another question first and seek to answer it, and that is, what exactly happened at the time of the rejection of the Messiahship of Jesus? Once we understand what the issues are in connection with the rejection of the Messiahship of Jesus, then and only then can we adequately begin to deal with the issue of what the basis or the prerequisite to the second coming will be. So as we begin this series, we are going to be answering two questions in this order. First, what exactly happened at the time of the rejection of the Messiahship of Jesus? And then secondly, in light of that, what is the basis or the precondition to the second coming? In answering the first question, we need to first of all look at the Gospel of Matthew chapter 12. Now for some background material, between chapters 4 and 12 of this Gospel, Jesus has been going around the land of Israel, proclaiming himself to be the Jewish Messiah, and then authenticating his claims with many miracles, signs, and wonders. Now the purpose of all of the miracles of Jesus between chapters 4 and 12 were for the purpose of serving as signs to Israel to get Israel to come to a decision regarding his person, that he is the Messiah, and his message, that he's offering to Israel the kingdom of the Jewish prophets. Now, Matthew 12, the purpose of his miracles, will undergo radical change, but for now, the thing we should note, but until the point of which we're about to read, the purpose of his miracles was to authenticate his person and his message, to serve as signs to Israel, to get Israel to come to a decision. I shall begin reading our passage for this series, which is Matthew chapter 12. I'll be reading verses 22 through verse 32. Then was brought unto him one possessed with a demon, blind and dumb, and he healed them, inasmuch as the dumb man spake and saw. And all the multitudes were amazed and said, Can this be the son of David? When the Pharisees heard it, they said, This man does not cast out demons, but by Beelzebub, the prince of demons. Now, knowing their thoughts, he said unto them, Every kingdom divided against itself is brought to desolation. Every city or house divided against itself shall not stand. And if Satan cast out Satan, he is divided against himself, and how then shall his kingdom stand? And if I by Beelzebub cast out demons, by whom do your sons cast them out? Therefore shall they be your judges. But if I by the Spirit of God cast out demons, then is the kingdom of God come upon you. Or how can one enter into the house of the strong man and spoil his goods, except he first bind the strong man, and then he will spoil his house? He that is not with me is against me, he that gathers not with me scatters. Therefore I say unto you, every sin and blasphemy shall be forgiven unto men, but the blasphemy against the Spirit shall not be forgiven. And whosoever shall speak a word against the Son of Man, it shall be forgiven him, but whosoever shall speak against the Holy Spirit, it shall not be forgiven him, neither in this age, nor in that which is to come. Now verse 22, Jesus casts out a demon that caused the person controlled to be both blind and dumb. Now, the act of casting out demons was not all that unusual in the Jewish world of this day. Even the Pharisees and the followers of the Pharisees were able to cast out demons. However, within the framework of Judaism, in order to cast out a demon, one had to use a specific ritual. In the course of this ritual, the first thing the exorcist would have to do is establish communication with the demon. When a demon speaks, he uses the vocal cords of the person he controls. Then secondly, after establishing communication with the demon, the next thing he would have to do is find out the demon's name. And then thirdly, only after knowing the demon's name could he, by use of that name, order and cast the demon out. Now that is the Judaistic methodology of casting out demons of that day. And on other occasions, we do find Jesus using the Jewish method, as for example in Mark chapter 5, where he's confronted by a demoniac of the Gadarenes, and Jesus, when he's confronted with the demoniac, asks the question, "What is your name?" And the answer he receives is, "My name is Legion, for we are many." But there was one kind of demon that Judaism was powerless against, and that was the kind of demon that caused the person controlled to be dumb or mute so that he could not speak. Since he could not speak, there was no way of establishing communication with that kind of a demon, no way of finding out that demon's name, and so within the framework of Judaism, it was impossible to cast this type of a demon out. However, the rabbis did teach that when Messiah comes, he'll even be able to cast out this kind of a demon. And in verse 22, that's exactly the kind of demon that Jesus casts out. Now, the rabbis of Jesus' day and prior to his day separate miracles into two categories. In one category were those miracles which anyone would be able to perform if he was empowered by the Spirit of God to do so. But in the second category, there were certain miracles which only the Messiah would be able to perform, and these were classed as messianic miracles, meaning miracles which only the Messiah would be able to do. And there were three main miracles in that second category. First of all, the healing of a leper. Secondly, the healing of anyone that was born blind. And thirdly, this particular miracle here, the casting out of a dumb demon. And so when Jesus cast this kind of a demon out in verse 22, in verse 23 of Matthew 12, that raises the very question among the Jewish masses that the miracle was intended to raise. Is this not the son of David? Or is this not the Jewish Messiah? He is doing the very things that we have been taught from childhood only the Messiah was supposed to be able to do. And while the Jewish masses are willing to raise the question, is this not the Messiah, they're not willing to come to a decision on their own. Instead, they're looking to the leadership, the Pharisees, to come to a decision for them. The Jewish people throughout our history have always labored under a complex that we call the leadership complex. Whichever way the leaders go, the people are sure to follow. We often see this in the pages of the Old Testament when we read that when the king did that which was right in the sight of the Lord, the people followed. But when the king did that which was evil in the sight of the Lord, the people also followed. Even nowadays, when we who are Jewish believers, the Messiahship of Jesus, testify of that fact to our Jewish contacts, sooner or later they tend to raise the same objection. And that is that if Jesus really was the Messiah, then how come our rabbis or leaders have not or do not believe on him? And the New Testament times, because of the unique stranglehold of Pharisaic Judaism, this complex was uniquely strong. So while the masses are willing to raise the question, is this not the son of David, they're not willing to come to a decision on their own, but instead they're looking to leadership to come to a decision for them. The Pharisees now have one of two options. The first option is to accept his messiahship in light of the evidence. The second option is to reject his messianic claims, but if they do take that second option, they must also be able to explain how come he is performing the very miracles that they themselves had taught only the Messiah would be able to do. In verse 24, we see the Pharisees take the second option. And by taking the second option, they claim that he is not the Messiah, and so the Messiahship of Jesus is officially rejected by the leadership. Also in verse 22, they also explain away his ability to perform these unique messianic miracles by saying that he himself is possessed, not by a common demon, but by the prince of demons, Beelzebub. And Beelzebub is a combination of two Hebrew words, which mean the Lord of the Flies. So this becomes the basis of the rejection of the Messiahship of Jesus. He's not the Messiah on the grounds of being demon-possessed. With this rejection, the nature and style of Christ's ministry will now change. And Jesus responds against the Pharisees by saying two things. And the second thing is especially crucial. However, our time on this broadcast is now coming to a close, and so we'll pick it up with this very point on our next broadcast. But as we close, may I remind you that the manuscript for this series is available by writing to Ariel Ministries, that's A-R-I-E-L, Ariel Ministries, P.O. Box 13266, that's P.O. Box 13266, San Antonio, Texas, 78213. So until next time, we bid you shalom. Thank you. This is the second part of our series that we are doing this week, in which we are entitling The Basis of the Second Coming of Jesus the Messiah, or what is the one condition that must be met before Jesus can return to set up his kingdom. And we pointed out in our first session yesterday that before we can adequately begin to deal with the issue of what is the basis of the second coming, we must raise another question first, and that is, what exactly happened at the time of the rejection of the Messiahship of Jesus. To deal with that first question, we turn to Matthew chapter 12 and noted that between chapters 4 and 12 of Matthew, Jesus has been going around the land of Israel, proclaiming himself to be the Jewish Messiah, and then authenticating these claims with many miracles, signs, and wonders. And the purpose of these miracles between chapters 4 and 12 were for the purpose of serving as signs to Israel to get Israel to come to a decision regarding this person. And in Matthew 12, verse 22, Jesus performed one of the three messianic miracles as they were classed by the rabbis, which was the casting out of a dumb demon. And because this was the kind of miracle which the rabbis had taught only Messiah would be able to do, in verse 23, this raised the question among the Jewish masses, is this not the son of David, or is he not the Messiah? After all, he is doing the very miracles that we have been taught from childhood only Messiah is supposed to be able to do. But I pointed out that while the Jewish people were willing to raise the question, they were not willing to come to a decision on their own. Instead, they were looking to leadership, the Pharisees, to make a decision for them. In verse 24, that decision is made. In verse 24, the leadership of Israel rejects the Messiahship of Jesus. It then explains away his ability to perform his miracles by saying that he himself is possessed by the prince of demons, Beelzebub, which means the Lord of the Flies in Hebrew, and this becomes the the basis of the Pharisaic rejection of the Messiahship of Jesus. He's not the Messiah on the grounds of being demon-possessed. To this, Jesus responds by saying two things. Number one, he says in verse 25 through 29, is that this cannot be true because it would mean a division in Satan's kingdom. But then secondly, in verses 30 through 32, he pronounces a judgment upon that generation of Israel that is now guilty of the unpardonable sin, the blasphemy of the Holy Spirit. And because this sin is exactly what it says it is unpardonable, judgment is now set against that generation, a judgment that cannot now be alleviated, a judgment that will be fulfilled 40 years later in the year 70 AD with the destruction of Jerusalem and the temple. Now we should make it very, very clear in our minds exactly what the unpardonable sin is in the context in which it is found. It is not an individual sin, but it is a national sin. It was committed by the Jewish generation of Jesus' day and cannot be applied to subsequent Jewish generations. And the content of the unpardonable sin is the national rejection of the Messiahship of Jesus while he was present on the grounds of being demon-possessed. I repeat. The unpardonable sin is, in the context in which it is always found, it is the national rejection of the Messiahship of Jesus while he was present on the grounds of being demon-possessed. The sin is not an individual sin, but a national one. Individuals could and did escape the judgment of the unpardonable sin, such as the Apostle Paul and others. But for the generation, for the nation of that generation, it was unpardonable. It is not a national, it is not an individual sin, but it is a national sin, limited to that point of history. It is not a sin that anyone can commit today. On this one thing, the Bible is very, very clear. Regardless of what sin anyone commits, all sins are forgivable if that person will come through God through Jesus the Messiah. The nature of that sin is irrelevant. All sins are forgivable if that person will come to God through Jesus the Messiah. But for the generation, for the nation of that generation as a nation, the sin is unforgivable and they are now under judgment. And the judgment will come in 70 AD. And it should be limited to that generation. And we shall see how during the course of our study this week, how two key words will keep cropping up in our study. And those two words are this generation. Because this generation is guilty of a very, very unique sin. Now having been stunned by these words of rebuke, in Matthew chapter 12, verse 38, the Pharisees now try to retake the offensive. Then certain scribes and Pharisees answered him, saying, "Teacher, we would see a sign from thee." At this point, the Pharisees come demanding yet another sign, as if Jesus had done nothing so far to authenticate his messiahship. Between chapters 4 and 12 of Matthew, he has performed numerous miracles, including the very miracles they themselves had labeled as messianic miracles. Yet in spite of all the evidence, they rejected his claims, and so Jesus now announces his new policy regarding his miracles in verses 39 and 40. "But he answered and said unto them, An evil and adulterous generation seeketh after a sign, and there shall no sign be given to it but the sign of Jonah the prophet. For as Jonah was 3 days and three nights in the belly of the whale, so shall the Son of Man be 3 days and three nights in the heart of the earth." To the demand for a sign, Jesus now announces a new policy regarding his miracles. That for the nation, as a nation, there'll be no more miracles except one, the sign of Jonah, the sign of resurrection. He will perform no more signs for the benefit of authenticating his message, to serve as signs to Israel to get them to come to a decision, because that decision has now been made. Now we know that Jesus continues to perform miracles even after this event, but the purpose of his miracles now change. No longer is the purpose of his miracles to authenticate his message or to serve as signs to Israel to come to a decision. They have now made that decision. Rather, the purpose of his miracles from this point on is for the training of the 12 apostles for the kind of work they will need to conduct because of this rejection, the kind of ministry they'll be conducting in the pages of the book of Acts. Before the nation, Jesus says, there'll be now no more signs except one, the sign of Jonah, which is the sign of resurrection. It is to come to Israel on three occasions. First, the resurrection of Lazarus. Secondly, the resurrection of Jesus. And then thirdly, the resurrection of the two witnesses during the course and scope of the Great Tribulation. After announcing his new policy regarding his miracles, he continues the words of judgment in verses 41 and 42. And notice carefully the emphasis upon that generation. The men of Nineveh shall stand up in the judgment with this generation and shall condemn it, for they repented of the preaching of Jonah, and behold, a greater than Jonah is here. The queen of the south shall rise up in the judgment with this generation and shall condemn it, for she came from the ends of the earth to hear the wisdom of Solomon, and behold, a greater than Solomon is here. Jesus now brings in the example or illustration of two Gentile elements of the Old Testament, the queen of Sheba and the men of Nineveh. Now these were Gentiles who had a lot less light to respond to, but the light that they did have, to that light they did respond. And so Jesus says that the great white throne judgment, these Gentiles will be able to stand and condemn this particular Jewish generation for being guilty of the unpardonable sin. But again, notice carefully the unique emphasis upon that particular generation. Now, the words of judgment conclude with a story about a demon, but our time is running short, and so we shall pick it up with the story about the demon who went out of a man in verses 43 through 45 at our next broadcast. Again, we are dealing with the basis of the second coming of the Messiahship of Jesus. And to understand the basis of the second coming, we first must understand all the issues involved at the time of the rejection of the Messiahship of Jesus. Also, let me remind you that the manuscript for this entire series of broadcasts on the basis of the second coming is available by writing to us at Ariel Ministries. Simply ask for manuscript number 4, or the manuscript on the basis of the second coming. Just write to Ariel Ministries, that's A-R-I-E-L, Ariel Ministries, at P.O. Box 13266, that's P.O. Box 13266, San Antonio, Texas. The zip code is 78213. And so until the next time, we bid you shalom, and may God speed and bless you. This is the third part of our present series in which we are dealing with the basis of the second coming of Jesus the Messiah. And we are trying to deal with this by asking and answering two questions. The first question is, what exactly happened at the time of the rejection of the Messiahship of Jesus? And then secondly, in light of that, what is the basis of the second coming? In dealing with that first question, what exactly happened at the time of the rejection of the Messiahship of Jesus, we have been dealing with the Gospel of Matthew chapter 12, where we have noted that the Pharisees finally rejected the Messiahship of Jesus on the grounds that Jesus was himself demon-possessed. At that point, Jesus pronounced a judgment upon that generation of Israel, stated that they were guilty of the unpardonable sin, and again, the unpardonable sin is the national rejection of the Messiahship of Jesus while he was present on the grounds of being demon-possessed, a sin that is national, not individual, limited to that generation of Jesus' day. And that's why we shall keep seeing, as we read in this series, the importance of the two words, this generation, the Jewish generation of Jesus' day, for being guilty of a very unique sin. Now, as of last time, we came to the section in Matthew 12, verses 43 through 45, where Jesus concludes his words of judgment with a story about a demon. Now, the point of this story is very often missed. The story, as we read in verse 43, but the unclean spirit, when he's gone out of the man, passes through lawless places seeking rest, but finds it not. Then says he, I'll return into my house whence I came out, and when he has come, he finds it empty, swept, and garnished. Then goes he and takes for himself seven other spirits more evil than himself. They enter in and dwell there, and the last state of that man has become worse than the first. Even so will it be also unto this evil generation. The story is of a demon that was not cast out, but simply left on his own free will, looking for a better individual in which he could live or indwell. In other words, he's searching for another apartment. As he searches, after a while he finds no vacancies, and so he decides to return to that person he had indwelled earlier. And upon his return, he finds that person swept, he finds him garnished, but at the same time, he still finds him empty. During the interval, the man never was possessed by another kind of spirit, be it the Holy Spirit or not a demonic spirit. So this demon now re-enters the man, but no longer wanting to live by himself, he invites seven of his demonic friends to join him. And the last state of that man has become worse than the first. Because at first he was possessed by only one demon, now he has eight demons residing in him. But the point of the story is that last phrase of verse 45, even so will it be also unto this evil generation. When this generation began, it began with the preaching of John the Baptist. And the calling of John was to prepare the nation for the acceptance of the Messiahship of Jesus. By means of the preaching of John, this generation was swept and this generation was garnished. But now with the rejection of his Messiahship, this generation also remains empty. And because it remains empty, the last state of this generation is to be worse than the first. At the first, this generation was under Roman domination. They had to pay tribute to Rome. Yet they retained a national entity. Jerusalem was standing and the temple was functioning in all of its Herodian glory. But 40 years after these words are stated will come the legions of Rome. After a two-year siege, Jerusalem will be destroyed, the temple torn down to not one stone stands upon another, and the Jewish people dispersed all over the world. And indeed, the last state of this generation did become worse than the first. From this point on, the whole nature and style of Christ's ministry undergoes some radical changes. It changes in four very crucial areas. The first area we already talked about last time, and that was the purpose of his miracles. No longer will the purpose of his miracles be for the purpose of serving as signs to Israel to get Israel to come to a decision. They have now made that decision. The purpose of all his miracles from this point on is for the training of the 12 disciples for the kind of work they have to conduct because of this rejection. The second area of change concerns the people for whom he performs these miracles. Until this event, he performed the miracles for the benefit of the masses without necessarily requiring them to have faith first. But from this point on, he performs miracles only for the benefit of individuals, in response to individuals' needs, and this time he will require them to have faith first. The third area of change concerns the message that he and his disciples are going to be giving. From before this event occurred, both Jesus and all of his disciples went around the whole land of Israel proclaiming his messiahship. One example of this is in Matthew chapter 10, where disciples were sent out two by two to do exactly that. But from this point on, he will forbid his disciples to tell that he is the Messiah as he institutes a policy of silence. So in Matthew chapter 16, when Peter makes his great confession, and Peter says, "You are the Christ, the Son of the living God," Jesus will then tell Peter, "Tell no man that I am the Christ or that I am the Messiah." The fourth area of change concerns his method of teaching. Until this point, when he taught the masses, he taught them clearly and in terms that they could and did understand. A good example of this is the Sermon on the Mount in Matthew chapters 5, 6, and 7. When Jesus was through with that sermon, we are told by Matthew that people clearly understood what he was saying, and they clearly knew where he differed from the scribes and the Pharisees. But from this point on, beginning in chapter 13 of Matthew, whenever Jesus teaches the masses, he teaches them only in parables. And when the disciples ask Jesus why has he begun using the parabolic method of teaching, Jesus will answer to them, "It is for the purpose of hiding the truth for the masses. Sufficient light has been given to them, and they did not respond, and so no further light will be given to them." And so he speaks only in parables so that they cannot and will not understand. It is impossible to fully understand why Jesus' ministry underwent these four changes unless we understand how crucial the events of Matthew 12 are and the issue of the unpardonable sin. But even after Matthew 12, periodically the Pharisees come demanding a sign, and Jesus' answer is always the same. For example, in Matthew 16, verses 1 through 4, we read, "And the Pharisees and Sadducees came, trying him, and asked him to show them a sign from heaven." To which Jesus responds in verse 4, "An evil and adulterous generation seeketh after a sign, and there shall no sign be given unto it but the sign of Jonah the prophet," and he departed from them. Whenever they come demanding a sign, the answer of Jesus is always the same. "For the nation there'll now be no more signs except one, the sign of Jonah, which is the sign of resurrection." And again, it is to come to Israel on three occasions. First, the resurrection of Lazarus. Secondly, the resurrection of Jesus. And then thirdly, the resurrection of the two witnesses during the Great Tribulation. Now, in order to more fully comprehend what the issues are, we will now turn to John chapter 11. In John 11, we have 44 verses giving us the details of the resurrection of Lazarus. Now, Lazarus is not the first person that Jesus ever raised from the dead. For all the other resurrection accounts are covered from 2 to 4 verses and no more. They are witnessed by only a few, and the few who do so witness it are told to tell no one about it. In marked contrast, in the case of Lazarus, we have a lot of detail, 44 verses worth, rather than being witnessed by the few, it is witnessed by the many. Now, what makes this resurrection more significant than the others? Well, this is the sign that Jesus has been promising them. And when this sign is given, they'll have to respond. If we look at John 11, verse 42, we'll know exactly for whom Lazarus is being raised. And I knew that thou hearest me always, but because of the multitude that stand around, I said it, that they may believe that thou didst send me. Clearly, then, Lazarus being resurrected for the benefit of the masses. And when this sign is given, they'll have to respond. So by the end of verse 44, Lazarus is resurrected and the first sign of Jonah is given. In verse 45, we begin to see the response. Many, therefore, of the Jews who came to Mary beheld that which he did, believed on him. But some of them went away to the Pharisees and told them the things which Jesus had done. Many Jewish people respond correctly and exercise faith. Brothers who are still belaboring under the same leadership complex merely report what has just occurred to the Pharisees. And because the Pharisees know very well that this is the sign Jesus has been promising them, they will have to respond in the official capacity, and so the Sanhedrin itself must meet because of the resurrection of Lazarus. And what the verdict of the Sanhedrin was as a response to the first sign of Jonah in the resurrection of Lazarus is something we'll pick up in our study next time. So until tomorrow, we bid you shalom.